Welcome, everyone, to Radiant Others, a klezmer music podcast. My name is Dan Blacksburg, and I'm excited to share the second episode of this podcast with you all. This episode features another interview with an artist whose work has made them an important part of the klezmer world. Today, I'm talking to cymbalist, composer, and musical organizer Pete Reshevsky. Let's take a listen. Before I introduce Pete, I want to take a moment to thank all of you who listened, downloaded, rated, and reviewed the first episode of the podcast featuring clarinetist Michael Winograd. Putting this podcast out in the world is the culmination of a lot of work, and it's been wonderful to have all of your great feedback and support. I also want to welcome everyone who's listening for the first time. Thank you for tuning in. Today's interviewee is Pete Reshevsky. Pete is based in Brooklyn and works around New York and all over the world. I first became aware of Pete at some of my first klez camps in the early to mid-2000s. Wandering around the massive lobby of the hotels in the Catskills where klez camp was held over the week of Christmas, I noticed that there was a guy with a cymbal, the Jewish version of the cembalum or hammered dulcimer, always set up in the corner of the room. This guy would be standing over his cymbal, hammering away for hours, often deep into the night, playing solo or jamming with whoever walked over and joined him. That was Pete. Today, Pete is a leading performer, composer, and researcher of the cymbal. He's toured and recorded internationally with Itzhak Perlman as part of the Klezmer Conservatory Band and collaborates with a number of leading figures in the contemporary klezmer scene, including Steven Greenman, Joel Rubin, Zhenya Lopatnik, Jake Schulmanman, and Karen Kleinman. He's performed everywhere from the Hollywood Bowl and Carnegie Hall to tiny clubs in Brooklyn and worked at just about every klezmer festival out there. Pete is also the executive director of the Center for Traditional Music and Dance, a nonprofit that works to preserve and present diverse immigrant music traditions from around the world, and a very important organization in recent klezmer history. He's also an instrumental part of Yiddish New York, serving on the organizing committee. Full disclosure, I also serve on the organizing committee. Pete is a tireless worker, a creative thinker, and a great player. I turn to Pete a lot these days whenever I need to talk out a grand idea or project, and he's always helped me dream big and get practical. Pete has a Wikipedia page, but not a dedicated website. So if you want to hear more of Pete, there's lots to check out on YouTube. And in honor of his work there, I recommend visiting Yiddish New York at www.yiddishnewyork.com, where you can check out the newly posted faculty and register for the 2017 program. Okay, I have just a few more items. I want to let you all know that I'm releasing my first klezmer trombone album on September 29th, 2017. It's also called Radiant Others, and to my knowledge, it's the first klezmer album to feature the trombone as a lead instrument. You can listen to the opening track and pre-order it at danblacksburg.bandcamp.com/album/radiantothers or through my website danblacksburg.com. I'm really proud of this music, and I hope that you'll check it out and pick up a copy. Again, I feel like I have to mention I'm making these episodes all on my own, and I'm still quite new at many of the aspects of production. I hope that you'll forgive any lower quality moments in this episode. Lastly, this is still a baby podcast, and I really need all your help in spreading the word. Please rate and review it in iTunes or wherever you listen to it, and please share it on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you social media. And send me your questions and feedback at dan@danblacksburg.com. I'd love to hear from you. That does it for me. Let's hear from Pete Reshevsky.
Thanks. This is exciting.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I'm ready. I'm bringing it today.
You're bringing it today.
I'm bringing it.
So the great Pete Reshevsky of Brooklyn, New York. That's right. So, let's see. So you're not from, where are you from originally?
I grew up in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
My dad was from Brooklyn, actually, not too far from here, in Midwood, Ocean Parkway.
Yeah.
My mom grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. And, my dad worked for Kodak for, gosh, almost 35 years, 40 years almost. So that's why we were in Rochester all those years.
What was music like in growing up? Like, was music a part of your life? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, in a few different ways. I mean, I had, first of all, I started Suzuki violin when I was like four.
Mm-hmm.
for someone who started at age four, I was pretty terrible, but, you mm-hmm. know, I had it embedded in me from an early age. You know, also there was, you know, other things going on. I would go to synagogue regularly with especially with my father, and we had a really good cantor, Sam Rosenbaum, who I didn't really know it at the time, but later on came to appreciate. I mean, he was like a big deal in the cantor's assembly. He was like, basically ran the cantor's assembly for many, many years.
Yeah.
And he was a real champion for like old time chazonis, the old time cantorial nusach, like you might hear from like Yossel Rosenblatt and Sirota and those guys. I mean,
and would he name check those guys or was
no?
He...
But just, you know, I later found out more about that. That's what he was doing. I mean, we kind of heard it every day, but I didn't really sort of have that appreciation for like what he was trying to do.
And he wasn't saying like, "Here's my concert, and I'm singing the Hashki Venu by so and so."
No, nothing like it. Just, well, he did that kind of stuff. We didn't really go to the concerts, but we just, you know, we would hear him every, you know, week.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I took bar mitzvah lessons from him, so you know, got real appreciation for, you know, cantorial music. Through that, my grandparents were from now it's Belarus. I mean, they would have said Poland or Russia.
Right.
It was my father's parents. So, you know, we would come down to Brooklyn, you know, a few times a year and be hearing, you know, sitting around the dinner table singing, you know, Yiddish folk songs and, you know, Yiddish theater tunes and things like that, and hearing stories after story about the old country coming to America and this and that.
That's awesome. So Yiddish music was like always in there.
Yeah.
And that was just something that you felt was like a natural part of your family life.
Yeah, yeah, especially, you know, through my grandparents, and I just love to hear all those stories time after time. And often, you know, our jokes were often the punchline was in Yiddish, so you wouldn't understand that part, but the,
yeah,
the rest
sense.
Of it you could kind of make out. You know, remembering just, you know, the little children's ditties like Shola Belechem Breeder Mushki Gay and Markton Kefa Kushki.
Yeah.
You know, that would always be followed by a cheek pinch or something like that.
That makes sense.
You know, so you had to kind of cover your cheeks, you know, uh-huh. really quick because
yeah, that's awesome.
Grandfather was on the prowl.
So it sounds like Jewish music was sort of your main musical reference point. As a kid in your family, or is that not?
Well, it was sort of in there. I don't know if I would say. I mean, I grew up, you know, listening to rock and roll and stuff like that, you know, of course. And
but that was on your own, or was that through your parents too?
No, mainly on my own. Although, you know, my mother, she's a dancer, so, and she would teach dance classes at the JCC and choreograph shows for the JCC. You know, like Broadway shows,
kind of, yeah, yeah,
you know, like Dames at Sea and the Fantastics and things like that. But I would also, you know, every time she had a birthday, I mean, what I would do is I would buy her like an album that I wanted to get. So I remember getting her Hall & Oates. You like Hall & Oates, right?
They're Philadelphia. Yeah, you gotta love them.
All right. And then I remember getting her like Michael Jackson's Thriller and Toto or something like that. Something like that.
How old were you then? Like in your early teens or even younger?
Yeah, probably early teens, maybe 13 or something.
So, yeah, you sort of discovered rock music through your friends or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing that happened was for my bar mitzvah, my mother, she did a really cool thing. She hired this inner city blues band from downtown Rochester, an African-American blues band,
mm-hmm.
Joe Beard and the Blues Union. Actually, I don't know if it was Joe Beard and the Blues Union. Joe Beard was kind of the most famous blues guy in Rochester. It wasn't Joe Beard and the Blues Union, but it was... It was a, you know, band from the inner city, and the night before my bar mitzvah, they played in the basement, and I remember not too many people were down there, but I was down there, my uncle's a nice blues guitarist, so he was down there. I remember my uncle Harry sitting in with the band, and that was sort of like mind-blowing to me, you know,
yeah.
It was sort of actually my first mind-blowing musical experience.
Awesome. See
Uncle Harry sitting in with this inner-city blues band down in my basement.
So it wasn't in the synagogue's basement?
No, it was the basement of our house.
The basement of your house?
Yeah, the basement of our house, yeah.
Whoa, your mom hired a band to play
great.
In the basement
of
your house.
None of the guests were down there except, as best I can recall, me and my uncle, you know.
Wait, so there was a dinner party going on.
Yeah, everybody
and
was upstairs.
And so how many people were there? Like 30 people or 40
maybe,
people or something
maybe
like that?
Maybe 30 or something.
Okay,
like
and then there's a blues band.
Maybe there was 40.
Like a professional band.
Yeah.
How big was it? Was it like a 6-piece band?
No, maybe a 4-piece. We didn't have a huge basement.
Well, I know.
That's big enough to have something like
that's
that.
That's amazing.
Maybe a 4-piece, 5-piece. But I remember they had a guitarist, blues guitarist. And I remember my Uncle Harry sitting in with them. And it just kind of blew my mind. So that was the first time I got really kind of enraptured by music. There were other times I remember playing some excerpts from Appalachian Spring or something like that in school orchestra or some hoedown number and really liking that in a way that was very different than when we were playing Mozart or something else. But it was that moment where I remember with Uncle Harry down in the basement the night before my bar mitzvah that really kind of turned me on to musical traditional music. And
you were really into this blues thing.
Yeah.
I was 13 on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, at the age 13, I remember I made a guitar. I made a tin can guitar. I made a few of these because I didn't have a guitar. So I took like fishing line and a big board and put a tin can in it and stretched the line across a couple strings across the tin can and would be strumming that for hours and hours like in my room. And I would even hook up like a earphone to it and tape the earphone on and plug it into the microphone thing of the stereo and, you know, and electrify it.
Right, because the headphone can kind of work as a microphone sometimes.
That's right.
How did you know how to do any of that stuff?
I don't know. I have
great.
No. Well, at some point you just kind of figure out if you take apart your mic, you see this microphone jack on your stereo, and you want to plug something in, and the only thing you have around is probably an old pair of Walkman earphones or something that.
You know, I don't know if that's people's general experience anymore.
Really? Oh, I'd be surprised.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I remember there were these really cheap plastic microphones you could get for those kinds of
Things.
Totally. You probably see those. They were like very, very cheap
plastic. Yeah, I remember growing up, we just had a microphone in the house. I think I used it for my first audition tape or something like that.
There you go. So you know what I'm talking about.
So awesome. So you had the Jewish thing was always in there.
Yeah.
The Yiddish thing was always in there.
Yeah.
Then you found music.
Yeah.
And now where are we up to? Like late teens?
Yeah. So I was heavily into traditional music. So I went, away to college. I went to Cornell, and when I was living in Ithaca, there was a really great British fingerstyle guitarist there, Martin Simpson. He's now one of the top dudes in the fingerstyle guitar world of England. He's very well known in England now, pretty well known. He was wonderful. So I used to see him, so I could sort of see, I can take the stuff I'm learning on blues with my guitar and apply it to this completely different traditional music. British Isles music, Irish and English, and there's a lot of people doing that kind of stuff with alternate guitar tunings and things like that. So I got into doing that, and
but you weren't in school for music, were you?
No. I was like math, economics was what I was studying.
Got it.
I never conceived of like that you could actually make a career of what I was doing.
Smart.
It wasn't even conceived of at the time.
What an idea.
I didn't know what, to me, like, the only thing you could either be a rock guitar, you could either be, like, in a rock band, or you could be, like, an orchestral musician. I didn't really kind of understand that there was all these other sort of niches for musicians to fill and things like that,
That's awesome. So you never thought, I'm going to go out there and be a musician?
No. Never really wanted to either. I mean, never.
Okay.
I was a folk musician, so for me the big thrill was just sitting around with a bunch of people and playing guitar, I got into banjo, I was playing banjo.
Right, now I think when I met you it was slightly after that, you were playing cymbalum, but definitely it seemed like all you wanted was to be surrounded by people playing music.
Well, that's no different than today, to tell you the truth. I mean, that hasn't really changed. But you know what, I mean, at the time I wasn't really hearing anything like, in terms of klezmer, that was to me inspiring at all. I mean, the only things I would hear like probably Klezmer Conservatory Band or Gyura Feidman.
You would have heard that stuff.
Well, I remember we had Gyura Feidman albums at home.
Okay.
And, or Fiddler on the Roof. And none of it inspired me. And none of it was like string music. I hear I was like a string musician.
Sure.
I was getting into like guitar, banjo. I liked the way like fiddles and banjos sounded together.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I wasn't hearing anything that had that kind of sound or that I could really, get into with what doing. So it was later, I guess at the end of college. Actually, there's a Philadelphia connection. I was dating a woman whose father was a klezmer clarinetist in Philadelphia.
Whoa.
Yeah. Marty Millison.
Okay.
It was a nice klezmer clarinet. He had this band Klezmore for
a while. I've never heard of him. I got to check that out.
Yeah, Marty was good. And so my first klezmer gig was actually playing with Marty on a gig. Playing my guitar with Marty. Nice. That was the first time I was sort of exposed
to that?
This would have been like 1992 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, 92, 93. And then maybe I played some guitar, maybe I played some banjo with him. I can't really remember. And then it was soon after that I heard Andy and Zev's album, you know. Maybe I was in, I think it was my first year in Michigan, I heard Andy and Zev's album, Andy Stab and Zev Feldman's Klezmer Music, 1979, Jewish Klezmer Music, which is, you know, still a high benchmark for the field, and Zev's a,
absolutely.
Zev's a cymbal player, Andy, of course, is clarinet and mandolin. So that was the first time I heard sort of this other sound of klezmer.
Yeah.
And my mother was in a klezmer band at the time, too, in Rochester. Oh, wow. Yeah, she was, dancing around and playing tambourine.
So this was so you were right in there when all these, because it sounded like the one in Philly also wasn't this guy wasn't doing it back in the day. It was a revival band
band. Yeah, sure.
And so the word got out that there was this music out there and they were playing, you know.
Yeah.
I imagine the repertoire there was like Hester Bulgar and Odessa Bulgar and stuff like that then.
I think from stuff from the Cayman. I remember Cayman books and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, I had Henry Sapoznik's book, Complete Klezmer, but the recording that came with it was all this big band music, and it didn't make any sense to me. Abe Schwartz and...
But you were looking for something that sounded like was this old time that you were already into? No, it was the British Isles stuff.
Yeah, but both. I was into old time, I was into British Isles stuff, I was into,
Thing that I've always noticed about, I didn't really... encounter that music growing up. I'm a mm-hmm. city kid. The mm-hmm. the folk music of Philadelphia at the mm-hmm. time, I was basically R&B and hip hop.
Yeah, sure.
And what was interesting when I first started going to these folk festivals and seeing those huge jams, like the really big jams, is the sound of all those strings creates like this super high overtone structure,
right?
Where it just sparkles.
Right.
There's this insane sparkle that you can't get with brass instruments, for example.
Right.
And all the mandolins, because there's just so much treble in there. And so maybe that's like, was that something that you were aware of? Or is, because when I hear what you're saying, I'm like imagining you're looking for that sound, but you're not hearing that in these big orchestra or big, you know, marching band kind of vibe recordings.
Right.
But then you get a cymbal and it's a lot closer.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was... that's interesting about the overtones, because I hadn't really thought about that piece, that, mm-hmm. that sparkle. But of course you get that from that. What it was is the timbre of a banjo or something, or, you know, later a hammered dulcimer. You know, kind of that sound of a struck or plucked string with a bowed string. Kind of something about that combination.
Yeah.
Really.
No, that's it, right? You know? Percussion and you know, melody.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, Zev and Andy did that, and there was nothing probably like that at all at the time, I would imagine. Nobody was playing cymbalum, right?
Yeah, well, there was Stuart Brotman out in West Coast about the same time, but, there was nothing else like... I mean, this was the earliest... I mean...
Sure.
Okay, so the other thing that happened around... What happened, 95, 96, was the Perlman, Itzhak Perlman, in the Fiddler's House.
Sure, yeah.
And so that was really important, too, because that was, you know, then I heard, okay, this is this presentation of string klezmer music, you know.
Ah, okay.
And Itzhak's playing with the Klezmag, he's playing with KCB and all that, but, you know, still it's about the, you know, the violin.
It's about the violin, right.
Primary thing.
And that was your first instrument.
And that was my first instrument.
Did you still play, or you kind of gave that
up? No, I didn't play. You know, I didn't play again until many years later. But but I still had it in me that this is, you know, this is sort of folk music, you know, some kind of folk
right. Well, it makes sense. It was
cool. So,
live in the Fiddler's House.
Yeah, well, in the Fiddler's House.
In the Fiddler's House.
I never saw it live. you know, which is ironic. I mean, now I'm playing on that program.
I think that, well, we'll talk about that. I definitely have a feeling. You know, one of the things that's so great about this music is you end up doing the things that you are inspired by.
I know. Well, it's a relatively small scene, so you end up playing with the people who you sort of grow up and idolize.
Well, not everybody in this scene plays with Pearlman, but but I know for me, I've always been drawn to the scenes where that was possible, where there was these certainly since I got into college or left home, you know, and sort of entered a bigger musical world.
Right.
It just made more sense because it was more fun when the people you loved were reachable.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I'm thinking about, you know, with these talking to you is just how do we make sure that this music stays that reachable to everybody who gets into it? I mean, I think it's not hard. We're not particularly unreachable, but we are very geographically concentrated.
Yeah, for the most part. I don't know. I mean, there's a number of ways to. I think there's a number of strategies or you know, things to think about when you're trying to figure out how to make it more accessible, how to make it more reachable. I mean, I think one thing most important is you have to give people a reason to why they would want to play this music. So,
right.
While at the same time you're talking about, like, how do we create, like, sort of entry-level portals for people to approach music. You also have to think about, okay, at the high end, we want people, like, making really, really great music at a very, very high level.
And in a number of ways, because
because if the music isn't great, you know, nobody's going to want to play it.
Right, but there are so many people who heard the KCB and just jumped right in.
Yeah.
But then for you, that didn't fly. That wasn't.
Like, yeah, it wasn't the sound I was looking for. Andy and Zeb were, and Zeb. You know, and they were doing it at a very
high level. It's interesting, right, because then I bet there's more KCB CDs. I mean, they only made that one record together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then Zev moved on to who knows what, and Andy moved on to all of his stuff.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess we'll have to, hopefully we can find that out in a future episode.
Right. Yeah. So, no, but that's a lot of, I mean, you know, so this is what I do my day job. You know, I work for this organization, Center for Traditional Music and Dance, and that's what an organization that was very heavily involved in getting the Klezmer Revival started back in the late 1970s with Andy and Zev and Dave Terrace and others. And this is the kind of thing we think about is, like, for, you know, any particular community or scene, how can we sort of assist them in, you know, learning from what other communities have tried, you know, using the creativity of the community itself and, you know, helping them to kind of find these portals for keeping the vitality of a music and, you know, or creative arts, you know, traditional arts scene.
So you kind of found your way into doing this full time.
I did. I mean, another thing I never imagined this is what I'd be doing, you know, for my day job. But
you never imagined.
But it makes a lot of sense.
Jewish music and
yeah.
How about that? Think about was the difference between me who kind of came to Klezmer very quickly and you who sort of came to it over a period, you know, you started playing cymbal, six, 7 years after you first started playing Klezmer music?
Probably.
Now it's your main instrument.
Yeah.
So when did you decide to switch over?
I was living in Buffalo and I had these two beautiful banjos stolen off my porch.
Oh, wow.
And it was thing, in hindsight, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me to just play cymbal.
How about that?
All the time. I was living in Syracuse at the time, actually.
Yeah. So, what was it? So, you started playing cymbal full time in when? Like, 2000, early 2000s? When, sorry, your banjos got stolen.
Yeah. Well, I think a few things happened. I remember at some point I moved to... I was living in Buffalo, and I remember going to a workshop that Joel Rubin was doing at Syracuse University, and I remember I walk into the workshop with my cymbal in a case, and he says... And Joel says, "What's that, a keyboard?" I said, "No, it's cymbal." Oh. Joel was impressed. So Joel's a dear friend. He's a wonderful, wonderful klezmer clarinet. He's one of the pioneers of the
Totally. You guys have revival. Worked together for a long time.
Yeah. Oh, so what happened, I guess, so I was in Buffalo playing my cymbal, and at one point Steve Green, and I would be playing a little bit, mainly banjo, but a little bit, a couple cymbal numbers in this... in this klezmer band in Rochester.
The 12, whatever.
12 Corners Klezmer Band. Yeah. And then at some point, Steve Greenman called me to help him with... He had a grant to do a workshop down in Cleveland. I think it was at the Case Western Hill Ale. And
you guys had met at Klez Camp or something.
Yeah, and I met Steve, you know, for a few years.
So you were guys... Camp. You were at this point, you were the young punks...
Oh, yeah.
And you were... And,
I wasn't even a punk. I was just a young...
Well, I mean, I wasn't a punk either. I'm just using your word. But, like, so you guys were starting to get your own gigs and figure some stuff out.
Who's that?
You and Steve.
Oh, no. Well, Steve was well-established. I mean, okay, so the other thing that was happening in the background around the mid-90s, I mean, there was the Perlman thing. But that's when Budowitz got going. So this was Steve and Walt Mahovlich and Josh Horowitz created this band. It was kind of bi-coastal, bi-national, between Austria and Cleveland, really, called Budowitz.
Yeah.
And they put out a couple albums that were, you know, very influential.
Those are great albums.
And so people were getting into, and there was Alicia's Fiddle album. So people were getting interested in, okay, we've been doing sort of the Dave Terrace, Neptula Brandwine thing for the first 10 years of the revival. You know, let's look back to Eastern Europe and with this more fiddle-based music.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of becoming a thing in klezmer. It was sort of an alternate path.
Right.
And it had a lot more resonance to me.
Sure.
You know, in terms of my, you know, my musical interest. So, so I started playing with Steve a little bit. And but then Alicia started calling me a lot to come down to New York.
Even then?
Yeah. So I would
Great.
So I would come down. I would stay for the weekend. We'd play. Friday night, I would get there, you know, around dinner time. She would feed me. They would go out, and I'd babysit her kids, and then we'd have, like, play a wedding on Saturday, maybe a concert on Sunday or something, and then I would head back to Buffalo or Syracuse or something like that.
Okay, so these relationships, they're kind of the, like you and Joel and you and Alicia
and Steve, you and Steve
are longer than I knew about.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so those three beat the shit out of me. Oh, can I say things like that on the podcast? They really kind of taught me how to be a musician and really, you know, how to accompany and, you know, be a sensitive musician and things, you know, all sorts of things like passing tones and
as you're finishing
things I didn't
school.
Really know about. Yeah, and also I was working with a wonderful singer in Boston, Becky Kaplan, Yiddish singer, and she was also very good about, you know, kind of... Especially for vocal music, you know, making sure my downbeats are on the right syllable of the Yiddish word and really understanding what the lyrics and how the lyrics interact with the melody and things like that.
What was your relationship to the language at that point? Were you into it? Were you kind of like, I play music?
Yeah, no, I was into it. Well, I just from learning so much, you know, and I was, you know, trying to consume as much research as I could.
Right, you're still doing your mapping.
Josh was putting out in his Budowitz liner notes and... Soon after that, Zeb Feldman with Hevrisa and Steve. I think I was going through the Weinrich book just on my own.
Oh, cool.
You know, and trying to speak Yiddish to my grandparents, my grandmother particularly, every time I came down to New York. So there was, you know, unfortunately, I didn't take a class, you know.
Yeah.
But, which I should have at the time, but,
you know, still time.
Self-study. There is. It's never too late. That's been the problem musically, too, is that a lot of my stuff has been, you know, just self-taught. You know, yeah. So I think that's held me back as a musician as well.
You feel like it's held you back.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And when we were coming up, we
didn't have all the resources like you do now online.
Which, I felt like I had all the resources because I was buying Klezmer CDs at Klez Camp. I bought the Abe Schwartz, King of Klezmer, you know, Naftali Brandwine, King of Klezmer Clarinet. So... You know, rather than having to, like, sit with 178 and trying to figure out what's underneath all the noise, yeah. I had remastered CD versions of sure. two dozen yeah,
we,
of these
no, we
things.
Certainly, we certainly benefited from
definitely,
that.
Definitely, yeah. definitely. So, you're playing gigs, you're gigging mm-hmm. now. You still don't think of yourself as a professional musician. Mm-hmm. You're just a guy who's like, I do really long drives on the weekends and I have yeah. no free time.
Yeah.
That was the light. And
I was just obsessed by the music and I loved it. And, you know, and then Joel came to Cornell and he was there doing a postdoc. And so I would go visit him on twice a week. And we would, you know, we're putting programs together that eventually became his Midnight Prayer album.
Yeah, it's a great album.
You know, that was something material we worked on for about 6, 7, 8 years together. Mm. It was great. It was a great learning experience. And I remember he'd showed me these pieces like from Moshe Baragovsky, who was a very important Ukrainian Jewish ethnomusicologist, worked between the 1920s and to the early 50s to really, you know, document klezmer music when nobody else really was in Eastern Europe. And, you know, some of the tunes he would bring me, the melody looked so simple. I'd like, what is this? You know, but when Joel would play it, he would breathe such life into it. He would really, you know, it just amazed me, these melodies that I would look at in the book and just say, who would want to play this? Looks like a dumb little ditty. But, they're, you know, Joel knew how to really kind of interpret them and breathe life into them and nuance. And so that really impressed me.
Think your thing was? Did you feel like you had a thing, or were you just, I'm gonna play with these people because this is totally enough?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, there were a couple things. So I, you know, when I was doing banjo, I sort of created a whole, you know, five string banjo is not a thing in klezmer, so I created a whole method for it. I wrote a book on it.
No, really?
Oh yeah.
Where's
yeah.
that?
Actually, you can get it online now if you Google klezmer five string banjo.
I didn't know that.
So you know, there I'd gone through that, and I mean, with cymbal, I mean, because you have so few models to go by, I mean, it's a lot of self invention.
Yeah, I can
you know?
Relate.
I mean, you try and do and you know, learning things from other traditions, non Jewish traditions that were co territorial, but trying to create some sense of all this and a style that says, okay, this is sort of what, not only what a traditional cymbal player did back in the first decade of the 20th century, which are the 10, 12 recordings we have, but saying, okay, if it continued to evolve and was, you know, vibrant all along, you know, what would it sound like today? So trying to, you know, take from Romanian music, from Hungarian music, from Greek music, from, you know, other traditions and create something. So there's a lot of creativity associated.
Yeah, I think that there's a...
associated with it.
I've always felt like we were creating this old tradition.
Yeah.
Or recreating, but yeah. It definitely is not the same as what it was.
Yeah, we're reimagining in a way.
We had to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you were in Irish music, you wouldn't have to, and they might not let you. You know, somebody's gonna be like, "Well, that's not right," and you can go off and do something that people will understand to be non-traditional.
Guess what? In Irish music. It's the same thing going on, and you know, just about any music. Where
I don't know. I just feel like there's some clear distinctions, and I could totally be wrong about this.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that there's clear distinctions between. Well, it's like easier to know where things came from. You know, mm-hmm. I was actually sitting in an Irish section a couple of weeks ago playing mm-hmm. trombone of all things, but.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about, oh, I learned this tune, and that was from this guy, and then his father, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, that's what an unbroken tradition sounds like. You
okay.
know?
Yeah.
Because they just, the dude was from Ireland, and he knew a guy who was related to this person, and it was just a clear, like, step-by-step trace back, as opposed to us, where you have to, like,
Yeah.
Not only time warp, but you have to you have to imagine things that didn't actually happen.
There's no doubt. I mean, we don't have, there's no country of Yiddish land that, you know, has existed. And
yeah, and there's no, and there's like, mid-60s Tsimbalem style that you could go back to and reject.
But you have to remember, with Irish music, I mean, this idea of instruments, different instruments playing together.
Oh, yeah.
Is a very new idea.
No, totally.
And that didn't happen before, say, the chieftains.
Right, I just started learning about that.
It used to be two fiddles or two bagpipes or whatever. That was the band, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, there you go. So I think there's a story. I mean, every tradition is going to have their own story, right? So yeah, so you were always aware that you were supposed to contribute and you were supposed to like make something of your own.
You know, as I got interested in Celtic musics and things like that, sort of the supremacy of melody.
Mm-hmm.
I like the melody being sort of the supreme thing rather than like it's sort of been a rhythm. You know, back in blues, you're sort of playing over a riff or, you know, a rhythmic structure, harmonic structure, whereas it's the supremacy of the melody. And I like that in klezmer, too. And that's one of the attractions with sort of these older European forms of klezmer that were more violin-led, more Baroque. You know, there's a real supremacy of melody.
Yeah.
And and I also saw, you know, a lot of connections of that with other parts of Irish music. Like, there's this whole tradition, this O'Carolan, Turlough O'Carolan was a blind Irish harper back in the 17th century who would go around Ireland and, you know, compose pieces. And they had a lot of sort of, they were sort of a hybrid between Irish traditional music and Baroque music. And I love that music, and I was, you know, playing that on banjo and guitar. And I saw the same thing happening in klezmer of the 19th century of, you know, these Baroque, sort of this fusion of Baroque and, you know, Jewish traditional music. And so I got more interested in sort of exploring that, and because the canon is so limited, you sort of have to start composing things to keep yourself interested in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's a really rewarding thing when you have, you know, pieces that, you know, you can perform in public that you've written and you know, sometimes if you get lucky, other people get inspired to play your music and things like that. So, that's always been part of the attraction.
Yeah. What's your first record that you made or CD?
The 12 Quarters Klezmer Band kind of CD, but my first one was with Eli Rosenblatt. So Ellie's now living in Israel. He's a wonderful klezmer violinist who I kind of grew up with at Klez Canada from Montreal. And so our first album, Cymbal and Fiddle, was in 2001. And that was, it's basically just, but what we did was we mainly took the source recordings, the fiddle cymbal source recordings, recorded those, as well as a few tunes from like the Kostakovsky book, which was 1917, something around there. New York publication of klezmer of the time, and some other sources.
Was that book publicly published? This was a question we just had yesterday.
Kostakovsky?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, back in the day, yeah.
It was something that, because I didn't know whether it was just a wedding book that was for the band.
Oh, no, no, that was a publication.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
So this was a general, like the Cayman book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah.
So you got, I think what's just interesting for me to notice is that you immediately had, I mean, you were playing with the klezmer band in your town, but it seems like the people who you really connected to were all over the place.
Yeah.
But then you were able to work together enough and develop your music enough that you could do something with
it. Well, it was just weird. Like, here I am playing cymbal for like 2-3 years, and I'm getting called by Alicia Spiegels to come down to play with. I mean, Alicia Spiegels wants to play with me?
Sure.
Why? I barely know where my E flat is on this instrument. You know? But that really kicked me in the tuchus to really, you know.
There you go.
To, you know.
The young upstart of your day.
Quickly.
Of the.
Well,
late
it was just 90s. Like, why? I mean, it was just kind of seemed incredible to me. But I mean, I just had the luck of sort of being the only person who was playing this instrument on the East Coast at the time.
I think that's a very similar story to me.
Yeah.
So now you live in New York. You got a couple kids, and you're the macher, right? You're in charge of everything. Everybody comes to you when they want something.
Well, that's not what it feels. It feels the opposite, but. Hopefully I have things to offer my friends when they ask. I don't know. But yeah, so I started working for Center for Traditional Music and Dance in 2006.
And you had never worked for a nonprofit arts organization
before. Never for an arts organization. No, I was working in healthcare.
But you were management.
Yeah, I was doing
executive. How did management. They? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, your credentials are, as a performer, and your involvement as a, sort of participant in the scene was.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting transition. That's not a transition.
It's joining the circus. Well, I think, first of all, they wanted someone who could run an organization. So we had Ethel Rame was the co-founder of CTMD, and she was there, and, is the artistic director. And so I had this wonderful experience. I got, 10 years of being trained. Ethel just retired recently.
Oh, okay.
But she's still very much involved in the organization.
Yeah, I can't really imagine
her. Nah, no other way. We wouldn't let her. so I had, a wonderful experience being able to work, from Ethel is one of these pioneers in public sector folk arts. In the U.S.
That's for a wonderful 10 years, term, yeah.
And really learn a lot from Ethel and, a lot of other people around the organization. But, they really wanted someone when I came in who knew about running organizations. They wanted someone who had that experience and who had, I think the other thing I brought was because I'd grown up in this klezmer revival or revitalization, whatever you want to call it, I had sort of a toolbox. What the infrastructure is that needs to be in place to revive a music culture,
or to keep it going,
or wider culture.
Or what is that? Okay, let's get into that. So, what is the toolbox that is necessary for a healthy folk culture?
Well, I shouldn't say the toolbox, but I had a toolbox, and I understood you needed a toolbox.
So what are
and think about things systemically,
So what are the systems that need to be placed, and what are the tricks of the trade?
Okay. Well, this could be a dialogue because I think you'll have as many ideas as I will on this. But
I may have some ideas.
I'm sure you will. So, but the first thing, you need great music at the top.
There you go.
You need great musicians making great music, making it very creatively and very rooted in the tradition, but also contemporizing it, the same way in a way that has a lot of fidelity to the tradition. So that's the first, because if you don't have that, then it's not even worth even trying any of this stuff. You need great people making great music.
Right.
You need to kind of, I don't know, I think the things I love about, klezmer and Yiddish is that, we've really connected it to a much wider cultural revival. So you have all that. You have a lot of institutions, organizations such as the Workman Circle, mm-hmm. such as the Folkspiel Yiddish Theater, such as YIVO, the YIVO Institute, Center for Jewish History,
right.
Eldridge Street. So you have sort of an infrastructure of institutions. Center for Traditional Music and Dance is part of that.
So all of that's in New York City.
Well, not all. You have Klez Canada's.
Klez Canada, yeah.
You had, Living Traditions in Klez Cam. And then you have all the overseas stuff that is, has been started up,
from
Weimar to, the festivals and going on in Moscow and things. So you have an infrastructure, you have a network. I mean, it's now these kinds of networks are easier to navigate because you got the internet, you got Facebook. So, sure. All our buddies are living in Berlin and...
Yeah, we know what they're up to.
Kharkiv, now. Ukraine, and Israel, and we know, we know what they had for breakfast
yesterday. Yeah, you don't have to say, I wonder what music they're playing.
Exactly, we know. They're posting their videos.
So you got a network and connection to a wider culture.
Yeah. And then you need sort of portals for people to get into to enter the tradition in different ways. And this varies on tradition to tradition. I mean, for us, we have, instrumentally, if you grow up playing band instruments, I see you as probably someone who came, you're probably playing in bands in high school, right? Wind bands and things
band,
like
orchestra,
that.
Jazz band. I'd say jazz band is probably the driving.
Right, right. So you had the tools to enter the...
Oh, yeah. I've been learning by ear since I was 12.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of
mostly
one stream.
Mostly because my band director was lazy. Brass, he was lazy, so he wouldn't write things out for us. That's why we learned by ear.
Right. I mean, I look at, the Suzuki, the kids growing up playing violin and things like that is another possible way to tap people, and people who are interested in old time music and, you know, absolutely, American folk music, you know, have, you know, they're playing, you know, instruments that can be applied to klezmer music.
So those are some portals.
Yeah, and so, and but each one of them is sort of each one of them is kind of a world unto itself.
Yes.
And so the question is, how do you best connect each one of those on into the scene? I mean, one issue we have with klezmer right now is we don't really have a great tune book. I don't think there's, like, sort of a great entry-level tune book that's easily available for people. I mean, I don't know what you think. I mean, the best ones, I think, are actually Sherry Mayron's slow jam books.
Are those publicly available easily?
Well, she sells them Sherry, online. But yeah, she sells them online. But
she's not.
It's a little harder. You know, when I was growing up, you could go to Borders and or Barnes & Noble or, you know, the record store, and you might see these. Or,
yeah, but you can find klezmer sheet music online.
Online, sure. Sure.
It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
But it's also confusing because you have to sort of start with the general search and just, you're like, is this good? Is this good? Like, you have no idea what's really real. I mean, complete klezmer, to me, always feels like more of a time and place thing than something that I would say, here, start with this.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
well, I'm sure if Henry wrote it now, he would have probably selected different tunes. And
right, those are so perfect. But then like you that. Also have a situation where if you're playing with klezmer musicians of a certain generation, that's their repertoire.
Yeah.
And location, you know? For the most part.
Sure.
So how are we doing? We got good music, we got portals, we've got infrastructure, I don't know.
Well, not enough of any of it.
Yeah, really. Right.
We need better music at the top.
Uh-huh.
We need, I mean, all of it, I think we need better outreach. There's no, you know, there needs to be like a good, you know, if you're a fiddler, I mean, you know, if you're into old-time fiddling, okay, American fiddling,
right,
you can get the Fiddler's Fake Book, which I have a copy on my shelf.
Sure.
And there's like 400 tunes in there, and it's really, you know, very easily organized, and,
yeah,
you know, it comes with, you know, well, here's the sort, here, you want to hear it, here, it's easy to hear it right here.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be things like that.
But what about, okay, so let's just get into that for a minute, though, because I remember my friend bought a Fiddler's Fake Book and was reading on it for sight reading practice and just forgetting picking and stuff. He's a rock guitar player, but he's very omnivorous. And it always felt to me like getting from the page, and I guess I don't really have a great perspective on this because I already had been playing klezmer for so long that I had a good sense of how to get from the page to a folk music. But I always felt like the page was a little bit better represented. Like the folk, the ultimate product of what it's supposed to sound like was a little bit better represented on the page than klezmer is, because klezmer is sort of pretty poorly represented in written music, right?
Yeah, well, it's a different kind of. I mean, one of the challenges with klezmer is klezmer was a professionalized music.
It was never a folk music.
Well,
parts. I mean, the parts of it, which
you mean
obvious
by folk music,
or what we think of as.
Yeah.
I mean, and also for a lot of people, I think klezmer means this huge thing, but you're talking about the dance tunes.
Yeah, well, you know,
those were professional tunes.
The guys like the Brandwines of your, your progenitors.
Sure,
They wouldn't have considered themselves folk musicians. No, they were professional musicians,
professional high quality musicians. Yeah,
yeah, and so it's a music that's in that sense it's a little bit harder to penetrate than like some certain Appalachian musics where it wasn't seen as a professional music. I mean, there were certainly professionals doing and playing dances and things like that, but everybody could access. You know, a lot of people would have, like, a fiddle on their wall and take it down. They could play a few tunes.
Yeah, this isn't great. It's not porch music.
That's great. Yeah, klezmer ain't like that, you know.
And that's an interesting thing, and I think most people don't even... I hadn't thought about that until recently, you know, where, oh, right, this isn't a folk... There wasn't a jam culture around this because it was professional music.
Yeah.
But the professional situations of learning it don't exist anymore, so I think we have to let it transition into this other thing, and then use those tools.
Yeah, well, we're recontextualizing the music.
I mean,
that's part
to,
of what we've been doing. Yeah,
because the context went
the
away
last 40 years. Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You had to recontextualize. You couldn't actually continue to contextualize it.
Yeah.
In this, it, at all, really.
Yeah. I mean, the context didn't completely go away. I mean, you're playing weddings and stuff regularly, but it changed a whole lot.
You know, you can talk to people like, you know, Susan and Elaine and said, klezmer never died in our house. It really was underground.
Yeah,
people for sure. really didn't. This stuff, for sure. like the stuff we're talking about right now, yeah, Yiddish Imamah did not really go away. Mm-hmm. You know, Tomb Balalaika never really went away. But, like, you know, a tune like, you know, Dem Triska Rebens Chassid or something like that, that wasn't, nobody was playing that in 1970.
Right.
Or 68.
Right.
Probably.
Or even 1930 or.
Or even, or, right.
Or late 20s.
Probably not.
Yeah.
And now we play it all the time. Yeah. That's like a real standard.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's interesting about the network that you talked about, like Klezkamp, well, there's two sides. One is all this is stuff like Klezkamp, Klez Canada, Yiddish Summer Weimar, even the festivals are all very limited in their time frame. Mm-hmm. They happen for a week. Maybe Yiddish Summer Weimar happens for like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
It's 6 weeks out of the year that you can actually go to a place where you feel like you're really doing this stuff.
Yeah.
Klezkamp is like 4 days.
Yeah.
You know, Yiddish New York was like, what, 5 days or something like this. So you had the entire world has been based around these super intensive situations. My entire experience learning this stuff was based around those. And then luckily when I was in school, what we did in school, and then when I was out of school, playing professional gigs. But if you don't get called for professional gigs, you're not going to have, and you don't go to school where there's a good klezmer band or a good klezmer program, you're not going to have that. You're going to have, you're going to have to carry it yourself. And that's a lot to ask of people, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side of it is there are all the stuff you mentioned, like CTMD or, you know, even the Hasidic connection, the stuff is happening year-round.
Mm-hmm.
It's all based in New York, primarily. Some of it's in Montreal. Right. I mean, there's a little Hasidic community in Philly, but I don't think, this is not where their energy is.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot missing.
Yeah. I mean, there's other
in
things.
In a year-round way.
Yeah, I mean, there's other things that other scenes have that klezmer doesn't have, and that, you know, maybe that's where it's kind of interesting. Well, like, let's take Irish music.
Perfect.
Okay. So Irish has an international organization, Cultus Cultori Éireann, which means a cultus.
Okay.
It's a group of Irish musicians, sure. basically. But it's an international organization. They have chapters in every major city and every city of any size, really, in North America and and Ireland and a bunch through Europe and things like that. And it sponsors, you know, each you know, regional group will, you know, usually have maybe a weekly or monthly jam session, plus a Kaylee. They'll be running Kaylee dances and things like that. And plus, they'll have a competition, an international competition. That's something that, you know, I don't really like competitions in one way.
However, I
have to say, if there's a way to motivate, especially kids and their parents about, you know, advancing in a particular music. I mean, you know, like, we had orchestra, you know, we had the All-State Orchestra when I was growing up, and you get a little pin, you know, look like a Congressional Medal of Honor.
That's
like,
interesting.
You know, we don't really have, I mean, that's one, I'm just saying that's one idea of something.
No, totally.
We could do.
They do that in old-time music. I remember watching these videos of these girls playing in a mall, and, you know, they're dressed like, you know, your most typical American, like, suburban person.
Yeah.
And then they're playing kind of deep folk music.
Yeah.
With chops, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is kind of amazing.
Yeah. Now, and as much as we don't like the idea of a competition in klezmer, it's not so foreign. I mean, there is this Amsterdam.
There's one of these things,
right? That's been, you know, I don't know how long and how regular it is, but this Amsterdam, and that's like for an ensemble.
It's kind of a chunk of change, right?
It is. I mean, but I see all these Americans actually signing up for it and paying their way to get over to Amsterdam to play for this thing. And, you know, they have stuff like that. So there's, you know, I think it's something you may want to think about doing that. You may want to think about having camps around certain pieces of the tradition, like maybe a fiddle camp.
Yeah.
Maybe a brass camp, you know, klezmer brass camp. That would be maybe a 2-day intensive thing just for brass musicians to get really in it, you know, as an intermediary period, because you don't want to have to throw a huge Yiddish New York or Klez Canada festival all, you know, at all different points during the year.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
And, you know, in the Hungarian community, you know, I mean, the Hungarian and Transylvanian music was revitalized in Budapest and other places through the tanchas, so the weekly dance sessions.
Yeah, that seems very vital and very successful.
Yeah, I mean, and there it was sort of a surreptitious thing because it was almost going against what the official government minted big folk ensembles were doing.
Oh, interesting.
It was more of an underground thing. So there was
a political
there was a political
edge. And it's also very geographically concentrated.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, so there's ideas that you can kind of co-opt from other scenes. And
I don't know, we need people trying things. Yeah, but if you had, like, what would you try? What would you try first?
Well, all sorts of, I mean, I think I would try a, first of all, I think we need a tune book.
Yeah.
I think a few of us need to get together and write a really nice, accessible tune book that could be, you know, mass marketed to
stores. That's doable.
I think that's important. I think, I'm interested in the fiddle camp idea. A few of us have been talking about trying to get something like that together just for fiddlers to, you know, mm-hmm. come for a weekend and do stuff. All of it. I mean, you know, we've started the Tonsoys thing, which I think we can breathe some more life into. You know, having a weekly, you know, dance or something. But I'd like to see it move around a little more to, you know, hit places and things like that.
It's a tough balance.
You know, so there's all sorts of things we could, you know, we could be trying. You know, Yiddish in New York is an experiment. I mean,
it certainly is.
2 years, it's been a lot of fun. You know, it's been sort of.
But it's also, I mean, it's new in the sense. I mean, I think the biggest difference about it is, unfortunately, one of the, you know, is that people go home at night.
Yeah.
And I think that's there's something that's really lost in not.
Being up
way too late
thing,
together.
Right. Yeah.
But I also understand, I mean, I'm completely clear that it's not possible.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe not for everybody, but maybe, like, you know, you could somehow rent, like, or borrow, like, you know, 30 rooms of a dormitory or something like that and stuff 60 people in there.
Yeah. But even that, it, I mean, it obviously, it's not the same as a lobby, you know?
Yeah,
a lobby was special, right?
For all those years.
Yeah. But, so it needs to change. And I know in Philly we've been doing these monthly sessions that are sort of like ear band, and as a trombone player I don't really have the instrumental clout to do a lot of specific things.
Yeah.
We don't have enough money to like bring. Well, we'll bring people down eventually, but it's I just find the volume.
Well, how have they been going? Tell me about.
Oh, it's great. You get anywhere from like 6 to 20 people.
Fantastic.
And we do it in the living room, and then at the end of the year, we do a big dance party, and and I get sort of most of the people, like the regulars, and the people who are, can kind of hack it, and who are interested in the scene, we do a couple, you know, maybe have two extra rehearsals, and then you play this dance party.
Yeah.
And it's great. I have people who help me out with that.
Yeah.
But, okay, so
I give you another crazy idea. Maybe there should be some kind of scholarship for, like, you know, a clarinetist, or people who are really, you know, young people who are really great who are going to NEC. Maybe there could be a klezmer scholarship at NEC.
Yeah, you listening, Hank Iznetsky?
Yeah, Hank, we're talking about you.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure Hank is, you know, is thinking about these things.
Yeah, of course. I know he's talking about...
NEC has been such, I mean, one of the main, you know, places where we've gotten a flow of great young musicians.
And I think one of the things that's come out of NEC is that you come out with high-level, creative, professional class people, you know, with professional high levels of professional training, and that's where you get, you know, all the people who come out of that. But coming from talking about, like, the string traditions or this other kind of, like, the recontextualizing it as really as folk music or as, like, you know, parlor music or porch music or stuff that you can, you know, one of the things I was so struck by in the Irish session was everybody was facing each other, and it was a master tune list, and you passed it around, everybody called a tune. And
there was a master tune list, really?
Well, it was a band. It wasn't a traditional Irish dance session. It was really like a ballad session, apparently. But like,
oh, okay. You mean they were singing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's a band. It's a band that just has a session every week.
Okay.
But people come in and play, and they play the repertoire of the band, which is large, and a lot of it's traditional.
Yeah.
You know, but you can also call the dude's original tunes on the list. But
yeah.
So it's like there's a piece of paper, and you say, I want to play that one.
Yeah.
And then everybody gets a chance to call one. And I thought that was really cool.
That's cool.
But the thing about everybody facing each other, you don't do that when you're playing. Because I've never played I've never played a formalized non-instrumental or only instrumental klezmer jam. It's always been with dancing and stuff like that. And it's like,
wait a minute. So it's gonna
like going to a bar, like a Tonsoys. Yeah. You can't look at each other. You got to be looking at the dancers.
Yeah.
But this was just for the musicians, and I think it was a really interesting way to think about developing repertoire. you know.
Okay.
So.
Well, but isn't that just a regular jam session where you're all in a circle? Which, you're right, doesn't happen too often in klezmer to begin with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's I guess that was what struck me about it, was that it didn't happen that often to begin with. And you know, even in jazz jams, it's not really like that. It's not so intimate. It's like, because you have like the rhythm section and the horn section.
Yeah.
You're usually still playing outwards to an audience.
Yeah.
At least in my experience.
Another thing that's hard with klezmer is I think there's more of a separation, I have to think about this, than in Irish music. In Irish music, basically everybody is a melody instrument, except for the boron, the drum player.
Right.
No, that's not true, because you do guitar. Have guitars. You do have guitars and mazuki.
But the particular style is not particularly...
But most people show up to the jam session should be able to... They're playing most of them are playing a melody instrument. Whereas klezmer, not always, you know, or, you know, if I get like a, you know, so in Yiddish New York, we had these jam sessions where, okay, we had a guy come in with, I think he was playing tenor sax or something like that. And then two accordions and a drummer, and nobody was really there to play melody.
Yeah, right.
So you need more people. Yeah, so it's a little bit.
So we need more melody players.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe jazz sessions are a better.
Maybe, or we need to figure out more kind of like genres. I mean, I think that's what's interesting. Well, the way that I do the minor, we learn everything by ear, so the accompaniment comes last, and everybody learns the melody first, and everybody's playing the melody, and it works kind of, but you kind of need all the parts, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it is dance music, so, and of course, we're only talking about one small part of, like, the whole Yiddish music world here.
Of course.
We're just such klezmer heads.
Yes.
I'm totally into it, though.
We're two of the biggest klezmer heads around.
We're not alone, but I'm totally into it. I think it's just really interesting to see, like, what we need right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to figure it out, because it's not going to keep going unless we keep going with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd keep going on its own. I mean, I'm not saying you and me. I'm just saying everybody who is... It's not something we can take for granted.
No.
And I'm sure none of these traditions are, but maybe it feels to me at least a little bit like... Old time has such a high volume of people doing it, and there's still so many families where it's like, this is what we do. There's a professional class, there's a non-professional class, there's workshops all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, and what, we get like 3 a year in North America, 2, unless you're in one of the few places that has sort of a hyper-local one.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Well, it's a much smaller... I mean, first of all, you're talking about you're dealing with a music that's basically serving less than 2% of the population.
That's a good point.
And it's... What is it? 1% of a 2%? I mean, you know, what percent of the Jewish population really understands this at all, what we're doing, and is really, really into it? I mean, it's just not part of a mainstream American culture in any way.
Yeah, but that's okay.
It's better than it used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it used to be, like, nobody even knew what klezmer was, you know.
But there were a lot of klezmer bands, though, like, in the 90s. Well, 20 years ago, it was 1997.
Okay, so maybe, like, before Pearlman and...
But there were a lot of klezmer bands. You were in Buffalo. Buffalo, it has a Jewish community, but it's not, like...
Buffalo is not... to, like, Dallas or Houston or...
There weren't any klezmer... I mean, there were a bunch in Philly, you know. No.
Well, or, you know, maybe they didn't have so much visibility. No, there were, you know, towns of... You know, big Jewish centers that really didn't have much going on.
That's interesting. I was thinking about...
Even now, let's say L.A. I mean, there's, you know, for the size of... I mean, L.A. being the second biggest Jewish population.
Right.
And how much do we really know about what's going on in L.A.? I mean, we know there's a few people working there, but...
It's a good point.
You know. A lot of Jews there in L.A.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's... I mean, maybe it's because the camps aren't out there. The camps are concentrated on the East Coast. So, and I think to a certain extent, people moved to L.A. because they wanted to get away from whatever culture they were, you know, they grew up in.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's totally possible.
You know.
Cool.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, at least you're working on it.
Well, we both are.
We both are.
and many of our friends are.
That's right.
Yeah.
Cool. What do you think? I think that we maybe did this.
Did we do it?
I think we did it.
Oh, should we do Tanz Freilichs now?
Let's do that. Why not? Let's play some music.
Oh, okay.
did record some tunes, but unfortunately, the sound quality did not actually make it to the level of something that I felt I could include. So instead, you'll have to listen to Pete and Jake Schulman Ment from Pete's latest CD, The Turnovka Sessions. And that's it. That's Pete Reshevsky. I think I learned a lot from him and a lot about him that I didn't know. And it's really exciting for me to learn more about these people who I've known and played music with for years. He's got a lot of great ideas and he's got a lot of great stories. So that's it for today's episode. And thank you all for listening. Please, again, rate us and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen, and send any feedback to danblacksburg.com or dan@danblacksburg.com. All right, well, have a great one, and good Shabbos.